Hey, hockey fans. Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
Axis Mundi.
Welcome to One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew L. Seidel, a constitutional attorney and the author of The Founding Myth and American Crusade. This is a podcast about religion, the law, and the battle for America's soul. We'll be separating church and state, defending freedom and equality, and fighting Christian nationalism. If you haven't already, sign up for our weekly bonus content and ad-free listening at accessmundi.us. LFG, folks. Welcome to One Nation. We begin this week with more winning in Oklahoma. Separation of church and state and real religious freedom are 3-for-3 in Oklahoma recently. Y'all remember Christian nationalist zealot Ryan Walzer, state superintendent, who we booted from office to much fanfare and celebration. Ryan Walzer foisted an absurd and overtly preachy set of social studies standards. That's a hard one to say. Overtly preachy set of social studies standards on the state. These were Judeo-Christian standards. I mean, it's this crazy stuff. It's got the Gulf of America in there. It's got COVID was created in a Chinese lab. It's got Joe Biden sucks. The 2020 election was stolen. In addition to, you know, Christianity's the best and everybody should follow it kind of stuff. And Americans United for Separation of Church and State, you'll remember, challenged these standards. Almost flying solo as the national legal group on this one, but with 33 brave plaintiffs, including Oklahoma Appleseed. And this was a really clever challenge because arguing the religion front in Oklahoma is hard. And it's especially hard when you're talking about teaching religion. You know, the rules are you can teach religion, but you can't preach it as truth. You can educate, but you can't indoctrinate. And it's generally harder when you're talking about standards that are in place to make those challenges. But AU brought a really, the lawyers there brought a really smart challenge. And they definitely argued their religion. For instance, there's a line in the lawsuit that talks about treating biblical accounts of ancient Israel as historical fact is an approach that directly conflicts with scholarly census, but the 2025 standards adopt an interpretation of the Bible that only certain religious groups adhere to, right? So you know, they do this, but our lawyers are also smart. And sometimes fighting a battle of attrition is a better idea. And getting the standards stopped, even if they're not declared unlawful because they are an abuse of power that imposes one narrow religious belief on kids, right? If you can get them stopped another way, go for it. Who cares what the legal rationale is so long as our freedoms are protected from this overreach and the religious freedom of kids is protected and the freedom of thought of kids is protected in the public schools. And so the Supreme Court of Oklahoma granted declaratory relief and concluded that the board's approval of the 2025 social studies standards was done using a procedure that violated the Oklahoma Open Meetings Act. And therefore, the standards were not enforceable and not applicable. They could not remain, that the 2025 standards were therefore not enforceable, and so the 2019 standards remained in force. Basically wiped them off because it was an abuse of power. Ryan Walters, the Christian nationalist, was abusing his power to try to circumvent the appropriate way to get new social studies standards into place so that he could impose his personal religion on other people's kids. That's what the goal was at the end of the day. And Walters had himself a little meltdown on the old social media in response to this. So let's take a listen.
The Supreme Court just launched an incredibly aggressive attack on Christianity, the Bible, on President Trump. The Oklahoma State Supreme Court striking down the history standards that so many Oklahomans demanded that we bring back an understanding of the role of the Bible in world history and American history, that we actually have our kids critically think about the 2020 election. They struck down the history standards, spitting in the face of so many Oklahomans and frankly, common sense.
So Oklahomans didn't want this. That's why 33 of them stood up and challenged this. And you know Oklahomans didn't want it, Ryan, because you went around the appropriate procedures to force it upon them. Because you were one of the most unpopular superintendents ever. People literally had parties when this guy got kicked out of office. Most people can't name their superintendent, let alone know that their life is so much better off without him that they throw a fucking party, Ryan. Come on. So, savor the win, folks. It's nice. It's nice to win. It's lovely to win. Enjoy it while we can. Now, I want to talk a little bit, even though it's slightly older news, about the murder of Rob Reiner. This hadn't happened when we recorded last. And in particular, I want to talk just a little bit about Donald Trump's absurd, callous, narcissistic reaction to it. But Rob Reiner was a really, he had a remarkable career. And I think some of the best work that he did was when he and his wife later on got very into fighting for the rights of other people and actually fighting Christian nationalism. Because some of you will remember that Rob Reiner produced a documentary called God and Country that was based off of Catherine Stewart's latest book, and which I appeared, for which I was interviewed. And, you know, I was very proud of my appearance in this film. Didn't necessarily agree with the overall message of the film, because I do think Christian nationalism is very Christian. I just don't think that Christian means good or good person. But one of the coolest things was seeing the arguments I've been making for years, the ones that I repeated on camera, work their way into the mainstream, and seeing this kind of persuasion that I've been doing for years, you know, kind of happening in real time. So we're going to take a little listen to a clip of one of the things that I said in this documentary, God and Country.
One of the things that I kind of specialize in is the myths and disinformation that make up the Christian nationalist identity. If you look at the Constitution, the really unique contributions are secular. The founders, when they were writing the Constitution in Philadelphia, they didn't invoke the Bible. They didn't turn to religious principles. And we know this because we have the records. It's very, very clear. It was secular by design, by choice. In fact, that actually pissed people off at the time. You know, it begins, we the people. Our Constitution was the first to do that. It was the first to draw power from the people and not a deity. No other country had done that before. It was the first in the history of the world to ban religious tests for public office. And it did so in language that was very clear and emphatic. It says, no religious test shall ever be required of any office or public trust under the United States. And even all of that was not enough for the founders. So that's just the original document. Then later on, they came along and said, we're actually gonna amend this, and we're gonna add in more protections. And so then you get the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. And in that, you have the founders separating state and church in an effort partly to protect religious freedom. They understood that there's really, it's impossible to have true religious freedom without a secular government. There is no freedom of religion without a government that is free from religion.
And so, again, this is an argument you've heard me make. Church-state separation is in our Constitution. It's there. It's there at least, you know, these three spots. It's all over the place. It's woven into the fabric of our Constitution. You know, name those three places. And I want to play a clip that from Rob Reiner's appearance on Morning Joe when the documentary was released.
They will tell you face to face that there is no separation of church and state in the Constitution. They'll tell you right there. You can say to them, no, it's there. There are three times it's mentioned very specifically because the people who came to this country were fleeing religious persecution. They didn't want to have a national religion for the country, and they separated. But they say, no, there's no separate. It's not in the Constitution. And it's right there three times.
Dan. And I just love this because this is a man who clearly cared about bettering the world around him and tackling the threats to progress and to making that world better. And cared about setting the record straight and correcting disinformation. And it was so wonderful to see him out there making those arguments in these mainstream places like Morning Joe that I've been making for you know, a decade. I did not work with Rob Reiner. I did not know him. I worked with Dan Partland, who was the director of the movie. But I respected the hell out of Reiner and his wife's work. I mean, they did some really wonderful, amazing work for LGBTQ people and for generally just improving the country. And I really hope that everybody goes and reads Donald Trump's post in response to this. You know, a famous couple, you know, it's two famous individuals die, two good, kind, generous people who wanted a better country are murdered in a horrific family tragedy, for which we of course know none of the details right away. And Trump's instinct is that their death, that loss, is just all about him. You know, please go read everything. Very early on in his second sentence, Trump writes about how this is due to the anger he caused others through his massive, unyielding, and incurable affliction with a mind-crippling disease known as Trump's derangement syndrome, commonly referred to as Trump as TDS. Right? That's not a thing. First of all, that's a shitty talking point from the other side that is trying to diffuse legitimate criticism of a man who is the antithesis of Rob and Michelle, who is working to destroy this country to build up his sick reputation in his own mind. You know, and then Trump goes on to post about how Reiner had driven people crazy by his raging obsession of President Donald Trump, with his obvious paranoia reaching new heights as the Trump administration surpassed all goals and expectations of greatness. Come the fuck on. With a golden age of America upon... I mean, this is just a man who is incapable of anything but narcissism. Just auto-fellatio all the way down. And it is kind of fascinating to see people who are MAGA, who have stood by Trump through so many things, snap out of it a little bit when it comes to this, right? They'll tolerate Trump. God, go back to the beginning, right? You know, mocking disabled reporters, Gold Star families, you know, inciting a violent insurrection to stop the beating heart of American democracy. Demonizing an entire people, calling a reporter who's a female a pig, right? Like, those things they'll defend, but you go after a celebrity that they like, who did movies that they like, who played roles that they remember and admire, and that's
That's too much. That's a bridge too far. And look, I'll take it. Yeah, do more to erode your support, Trump. I really do hope you, everybody. In fact, you should share Trump's response and let people know who Rob and Michelle Reiner were. Not necessarily their great civil rights work or God and Country, but, you know, When Harry Met Sally and A Few Good Men. God, I fucking love that movie. Right, let them know that that's who Trump is making all about himself. And it's also worth remembering, and I'll include the link to this Reuters story in the show notes, but this reaction is just so gross for, I mean, so many reasons. Like, this could go, this should be in psychology textbooks, I would imagine. But Reuters did an investigation where they found that 600 Americans, more than 600 Americans, were punished in a pro-Trump crackdown, as they called it, after the Charlie Kirk was murdered. So in the 2 months after Charlie Kirk's murder, you know, this government-backed campaign has led to firing, suspensions, investigations, and other action against more than 600 people. Right, so like 600 people were fired, basically, give or take, for saying something negative about Charlie Kirk after he was murdered. And maybe not, in some cases, not even saying something negative, posting Charlie Kirk's own words. You know, I mean, and the Reuters article points out rightly that J.D. Vance himself was hosting Kirk's podcast afterwards and talked about, I called on the listeners to call them out and hell, call their employer, meaning people who said something that could be viewed negatively about Charlie Kirk. And meanwhile, the president of the United States himself, the head of MAGA, is posting this in the wake of a murder. It is truly despicable. There is no floor. Trump will keep digging deeper and deeper. There is no level to which he will not sink. So we talked in a past episode about the why of the attacks off the coast of Venezuela, the attacks on these boats, whether it's a war crime, but also the why these are happening. And I think I want to spend a little time clarifying and drilling down on that, because I did get some follow-ups, and there are some really respected folks who have been writing and thinking about this as well. Asha Rangappa, who is a brilliant lawyer in the national security space. And I think there's some clarifications that can be made to that. I think white Christian nationalism plays a major and perhaps primary role in justifying what appear to be war crimes, except there's no war, so they're just crimes, they're murder. But let's talk about those boats, and let's think about, given Trump's address the other day, why go to war with Venezuela in the first place? If white Christian nationalists are all about making America great again and America first and dragging this country back to a white Christian nation that never really existed, why start a war with a foreign country? Why? So let's ask that question. So let's refine our question and see if we can't answer that. Because you listen to Trump and it's regime change in oil. But regime change is kind of hard to swallow, because who really cares? Does Trump really give a shit? He doesn't seem to have a problem with any other dictators. Unless this is revenge for something. Or this is because someone else is paying him to oust Maduro. Regime change just doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. Unless there is some financial gain in it for Trump. In which case people are like, well, oil maybe, right? And I just don't know. I think Trump likes that idea. And I think certainly some of his, there's other old white men in his orbit that like that idea. And I think it will make oil executives rich. But those are not necessarily going to redound the benefit of the United States of America in any way, shape, or form. And that's not Trump's operating principle anyway. You know, maybe these are businessmen who have convinced him that they were wronged. But again, Trump is not the kind of guy to do something for somebody else. These two, I don't really think are the true reason behind the actions.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
And I think this was validated by a story in the Washington Post. And the story basically reports that the original plans for these attacks, for blowing up boats, was actually Mexican boats that they were going to blow up off the coast of Mexico. But then Mexico started cracking down on the cartels itself, and I guess there was maybe a lack of targets. So they here is really Stephen Miller, if you read the story, just kind of chose another country. And this makes sense, right? Because if you go back and listen to when we were first talking about this, right, we know that they say that fentanyl is the reason for attacking these boats, but fentanyl doesn't come from Venezuela. Now, the precursor drugs do come from China through Mexico, where it's made into fentanyl and then come into the country. So attacking Mexico or Mexican boats here, if you're really worried about fentanyl, that makes more sense, at least. But if Mexico got their shit in order, and you still want to do this, even though the fentanyl is not there, you know, maybe that justification, rhetorical justification stays, even though you're just subbing in a new country, just picking out a new country, throwing a dart at a map and hitting a new South American country, right? But so if this is true, and if Mexico got their shit together, and if Mexico is doing what you want it to do, why do you still need to bomb people? That's a question. Why do you still need the war? Why not? Why do you just have to pick? Why do you have to throw that dart? Why do you have to pick another country? Why are you searching around for a substitute place to attack Stephen Miller? Because that's what the Washington Post is reporting is happening. It's not because of oil, not because of regime change, right? So those are clearly convenient excuses. So if it's Stephen Miller that's pushing this along, and we know that he is obsessed with immigration and remigration and the white Christian nation and all of the Nazi bullshit that goes along with this. If this is part of his goal of that white Christian nation, how would war with a country like Venezuela or Mexico, since it doesn't really seem to matter, help him with that goal? That's the real question here. That's the question that we need to be asking ourselves. Not are these war crimes, though interesting, but if we are trying to have war with a country to the south of us, and it doesn't seem to matter which, whatever rhetorical justifications they're giving, why? How does that war help Stephen Miller's, because this is him, his goal of a white Christian nation? That's what I've been thinking about. And it brings me back to one of the worst Supreme Court decisions of all time. Korematsu. And when I think about the Korematsu case, it is one of the worst decisions that the U.S. Supreme Court has ever made. It essentially allowed the United States of America to put anyone of Japanese ancestry or who looked like they might have Japanese ancestry in internment camps here in the lower 48 states. And it is worth reading Justice Robert Jackson's dissent in that case. Jackson actually took a leave of absence from the Supreme Court to prosecute Nazi war crimes as the chief counsel at Nuremberg. And he even checked himself out of the hospital on the day Brown versus Board of Education was handed down because he wanted to be present in the courtroom to emphasize the court's unanimity in that historic case. And in Korematsu, he wrote one of the court's most famous dissents condemning those internment camps. And this is what I think Stephen Miller is looking for. So if it could be the case that we are at war with Venezuela, we'll get to whether or not Congress could declare war, would declare war in a minute. But if we're at war with Venezuela, the president's powers are now even bigger. Trump could do even more. And suddenly, where Venezuela is the enemy, and everybody who is brown is the enemy or could be from Venezuela, they're now a threat to national security in a way they weren't before. That's what we're going to hear from the Trump regime and Miller. And we're also on war footing, so if you call this bullshit racism out, you are now siding with the enemy. You are now a threat. And that middle section of the country turns against you, because nothing unites the United States like going to war. And we've never been so divided. So there is a world in which declaring war, going to war against a Latin or South American country, allows the president to assume more powers and put Latinos and brown people in camps as the enemy. There's historical precedent for it, and there's legal precedent for it. I mean, there's something called the Alien Enemies Act. You've heard of it before, even if you don't remember it. It's one of those notorious Alien and Sedition Acts of 1798. And basically says that during wartime, a declared war, right, that's an important distinction, it grants the president the authority to detain or deport people from an enemy nation. And this is what Trump was trying to use, right? They were dipping their toes in the water with this. They were the raptors testing the fences early in the administration with this, when they were rounding up brown people that Trump claimed were part of Tren de Aragua, and it was later struck down by a court. But he had an executive order that he signed on day one, trying to, quote, make operational preparations regarding the implementation of any decision I make to invoke the Alien Enemies Act. Right, this is. Remember back when they put the 200, 250 people on airplanes to ship them off to prisons in other countries? So this is mass incarceration and deportation as an exercise of national security and presidential war powers. That seems to me like the end game of this war that we seem to be leading up to. Racism. It's a mean little bigot who is close to power in Stephen Miller, whose family were Russian Jews who benefited from immigrating to the United States, and who now wants to pull the ladder up behind his family. And that's what worries me. And the current roadblock to that is, it should be the case that that Alien Enemies Act can only be invoked during a declared war, which requires Congress. I don't know about you. I don't have a lot of faith in Congress. The idea of Congress checking Trump's power is, it keeps me up at night. So, that's what I worry about. And given what we know so far about Maduro and oil and why we're actually attacking these boats off the coast of Venezuela, it seems to me like this is where that is where all of this is heading, to an invocation of the Alien Enemies Act and internment camps for brown people in the United States in 2026, I'll say. And yes, this is something that keeps me up at night. Again, we're not there yet, but better to be thinking about it now. So let's talk a little bit, because that was heavy, about something that's much lighter. Let's talk about the Vanity Fair article with the interviews with Susie Wiles and the photographs of the operatives in the Trump regime. And the first thing is, you know, why? Hopefully you all have seen this. The link to the story itself is in the show notes. Go look at the pictures and go enjoy the internet's reaction to the picture. You deserve it. If you exist in the United States in 2025 and you have any kind of empathy at all, you deserve to see the internet's reaction to the photographs that accompany the Vanity Fair story. But let's talk a little bit first about why does this matter? And I think it does actually matter quite a bit. And I think it matters because it shows a group of people and the person in charge of this administration and Susie Wiles, the chief of staff, who are basically completely disconnected from reality and from everyday people. And that matters. It matters because even in an autocracy, in a theocracy, in a fascist state, the people in power need a certain amount of popular support. And it appears that that popular support is now eroding. Donald Trump has never been more unpopular. And that support is eroding even within his base, which is quite important. And this includes his political allies in Congress, as you can see from some of the most recent discharge votes, for instance, that have been taken. Marjorie Taylor Greene, another, for instance. So reading this story not only brings me joy, and seeing these pictures bring me joy, not only because they are so awful, right? They capture the true essence of these people, lip injection marks and all. Right, and it, you know, the close-up shots really show the moral decay of these people and the way that it ages them and the ugliness that they have deep down is also making its way to the surface. And then the wider shots just show how small they really are. So it brings me joy, but it also gives me hope that they're not going to succeed, that they're not going to win. They don't understand enough about what's really happening to win. Maybe they can win an election, right? Susie Wiles did win an election for Trump, but she clearly has no fucking idea how to govern. And there's nothing in there, in that entire story, for instance, that suggests they are going to do anything or change anything or make any productive strides towards winning the midterms. And if you're at all worried about what I was just talking about with war with Venezuela and internment camps, you should be doing your fucking damnedest to make sure that Democrats win in the midterms and that there is some congressional check on Trump's power. So reading that story to me just suggested that they were going to sleepwalk into a wood chipper of an election. And, you know, I know there are those of you out there who think he's going to cancel the elections. And I get where you're coming from. I just think that is far less likely to happen during a midterm. Generally because it puts Trump out on a limb for other people. But also because it's going to be harder to do with that popular support crumbling away. And that move, were he to take it, would make his support crumbles so much further. And that's the point that I'm trying to make here. And look, let's just read a couple highlights from the story because, you know, we get some of these lovely little lines about Russell Vogt, the architect of Project 2025. This is a guy who has written pieces about why he's a Christian nationalist and defending the term Christian nationalist. Susie Wiles says he's a, quote, right-wing absolute zealot. Wiles calls Vance a conspiracy theorist for a decade. She also, for all the negative things that are in there, she says that, quote, in this is the story, quote, in Wiles's view, RFK Jr.'s shock treatment of HHS is warranted. Then quoting Wiles within the story, quote, he pushes the envelope, some would say too far, but I say in order to get back to the middle, you have to push it too far. So this is just fucking stupid. That is a stupid thing to say. That is a stupid thing to say because health and science are not left or right. We should let science be science and not put it on a political spectrum that requires being absolutely insane to try to drag it to a middle that does not exist. Right? Facts don't have a bias unless you don't live in reality. So this tells us that Wiles does not live in reality. She's insulated from the real world. And she's very clearly, you know, Vance calls her a facilitator, but she's very clearly an enabler, even though she denies that term. We'll get to that in a second. She does to ask, there is a discussion in there that is recounted about will the president run for a third term? Weil says, no, he's just having fun with it. It's driving people crazy. 100%, that's why he's talking about it, she says. The journalist says, would you say categorically no? The 22nd Amendment rules out. And Weil says, I do. I'm not a lawyer, but based on my reading, it's pretty unequivocal. And that Trump has told her as much. So, you know, according to Wiles, Trump is trolling people when he talks about his third term. But the problem with that is that it's crazy how often these trolling things escalate for the other side, right? Things that they do to troll and they do to own the libs escalate. They essentially dare themselves into doing something. They force themselves to one-up what they have previously said and done. And so one of the themes of this story is the role of the chief of staff, which is the position Wiles holds, and that you cannot be a yes person. You cannot be a yes man. Wiles even says, I hear stories from my predecessors about these seminal moments where you have to go in and tell the president what he wants to do is unconstitutional or will cost lives. I don't have that. Which isn't, again, an insane thing to say. The reason she doesn't have that is not because Trump isn't doing things that are unconstitutional or will cost lives. It's because she's a coward. And because she's an enabler. Because she will not and cannot stand up to him, despite the fact that he's acting unconstitutionally and killing people, killing thousands of people in the instance of gutting USAID. She's a coward. She's an enabler. She says, so no, I'm not an enabler. She absolutely is. Of course you are. Because anything less in Trump world is disloyalty. He doesn't value dissent. He requires obedience. You know, on my team at work, in my day job, I tell my team that they have a duty to disagree with me. And the reason I do that is because I don't want people to just agree with me. And not, I don't want them to have permission to disagree. I want them to know that they must disagree with me, to give them the protection of putting this as an affirmative duty on them. If I am wrong, or you think I'm wrong, or you think I'm off, you have to tell me. It's not that I want you to, it's that you must. You have a duty to tell me. Now, along with that duty also comes a duty to, you know, when a decision is made, to go along with it. But you don't just get to say, yeah, I agree, when you don't. That's not the way I operate. I think it's a valuable principle of leadership, and it's completely alien to what Trump is looking for. You know, and so the overall story is that Wiles comes across as this adept political operator, right? She's like this woman who can manipulate broken narcissistic men, you know, not like some ideologue or bigot, church-going for sure, but basically kind of like just a power broker. And to me, that just makes it so much worse, right? She is willingly presiding over war crimes and murder and inhumane racist scapegoating, pardoning the worst people, probably in return for something, attacking political enemies, self-dealing and enriching Trump's crime family on crypto and other rewards from some of our most inveterate enemies. She doesn't restrain ever. She enables at every single turn. Worth your time to read, worth your time to look at the photos, and certainly worth your time to spend a little bit of time on social media and enjoy the reaction to the photos. You've earned it, friends. You have. And lastly, I want to end today before I say happy holidays by saying I am so fucking sick of AI on everything. I really don't want your shitty AI tools. I'm not interested in them for my emails, for my text messages, for my direct messages, for my Google Docs, for prepping this podcast. I won't click. I don't want them. I don't want them turned on. I don't want them on my phone. I don't want them on my house. I don't want them on my TV or any of those. You know, Green Eggs and Ham? I read this book out loud to my kids all the time. And he goes through the litany of places he doesn't want. I want AI and, like, same thing. None of those fucking places. Just get rid of it. I have no desire for it. It sucks. Ask it about something that you know about, and you'll see how bad it sucks. I don't know if I've told this story on this podcast, but it's worth repeating that after I dressed in drag in Texas to protest the drag ban there, especially at West Texas A&M University, I got asked to do a podcast and I got sent a biography of myself, a short bio. So it wasn't short, it was 3,000 words that they had asked AI to write about me. And it was so bad and so wrong. And you could clearly tell what it had done, right? It had created some sort, copied and pasted pieces of my bio together, then slightly changed the wording to avoid copyright problems and slightly changed things. But so that instead of going to the University of Denver Law School, you know, I went to the University of Colorado Law School, things like that, that make no sense, that clearly were just slight changes, changed the degrees that I had, changed my expertise, slightly changed the names of the books I wrote. Terrible from beginning to end. I hate it. I don't want it. It's wasteful. It's not worth our time. I want AI that does the hard, mind-numbing things for me, not that takes away the fun stuff like writing or thinking. That ain't what I'm here for. Stop using it. Boycott it. And yes, part of this rant is because I've discovered that my books were among those that were stolen to help build up these large language models. And I'm bitter and angry about it. Fuck you for stealing my work. It took me a long time to write those books, and I spent so many hours agonizing over each word, and fuck you for stealing it. But happy holidays to you, dear listeners. I love each and every one of you. I so appreciate the support. I hope you get a break this holiday season. I hope you get to rest. I hope you get to relax. I do want to tell you about all the books I've read this year and my favorites, but I think that may have to wait till the new year. We've got an episode coming up with my friend Rob Boston, who's been fighting Christian nationalism for 40 years professionally. We're going to hear from him about the lessons he's learned because he's retiring. Then we're going to talk to Erica Smith, who's this brilliant sex educator who helps people deal with the lasting harm and shame of purity culture. And then maybe in the new year, we'll do the book roundup for folks, depending on what the new year brings. I love you all. Thank you for joining. Talk soon.
This has been One Nation Indivisible. I'm Andrew Seidel. Until next time.
Hockey fans, can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.